You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps on the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jemima Pierre, Associate Professor of African American Studies at UCLA, and Brian Concannon, Executive Director of Project Blueprint, Advisor to the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, on the rolling death of democracy and the U.S. greenlighting of dictatorship in Haiti. Also on the program today, 10 people dead in a mass shooting in Boulder, Colorado, days after the NRA helped strike down an assault weapon ban in that city. Health officials question AstraZeneca's efficacy data. Global COVID deaths are up for the first time in a month and a half. And as U.S. testing drops, the White House is now concerned that Johnson & Johnson won't hit their vaccine production goals. Joe Biden reportedly prepping a $3 trillion infrastructure bill. But people are saying even Joe Manchin was calling for $4 trillion. What the hey? Bernie Sanders prepping a drug cost reform bill for the next round of reconciliation. And Louis DeJoy rolls out his plan to debilitate the Postal Service. Evanston, Illinois has now approved reparations for black descendants of slaves. As far as we can tell, the first municipality to do so in the country. USDA to increase SNAP payments by 15% through September. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. As always, joining me, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for asking. It's nice. I appreciate that.
Better allergies today?
We'll see. I got hit. Viewers of the program will know. Like at one point in the middle of the show yesterday, I got hit by allergies. It lasted all the way through this morning. And I took a allergy medication, and I was fine. And then 4 minutes before the show starts, it feels like it was coming back. Now it feels like it's gone again.
Okay. Well, we'll all stay tuned. Stand back and stand by for Sam's allergies.
It really does have a feel like today should be Friday, doesn't it? I mean, there's some weeks you start out and you feel like at the beginning of the week it should be Friday already. I'm getting part of that. I think part of it is because spring has sprung. Let's get right into this. There have been hearings on the Hill for H.R. 51, which is a bill to provide statehood for Washington, D.C. There are hearings now happening at the House Oversight and Reform Committee. This is one of those bills which will need, ultimately, the dissolution of the filibuster in the Senate. What's happening now is the House is getting ready to pass all these bills and just basically loading it up. And then it's up to the Senate as to whether or not these things will become law. D.C. is not represented in our government by voting members in the House or the Senate. And here is Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib explaining how bizarre in many respects it is that D.C. does not have this kind of representation relative to the rest of the world. Here she is.
Friends across the aisle love to talk about taxation, local control, and federal overreach whenever it happens in their states. I'd like to focus on these topics as they impact the D.C. residents. Congress has always required D.C. residents to pay all federal taxes while denying D.C. residents a vote in Congress on how the money is spent. D.C. residents have no vote on the federal laws that govern them and no vote on the federal executive branch and judicial branch officials who enforce and interpret those laws. In fact, we here in Congress, who come in from places like Idaho, Texas, California, have the final say on the local laws that govern D.C. residents and on the local executive branch and judicial branch officials who enforce and interpret those laws. So, Mr. Henderson, other than the United States, how many democracies deny the residents of their capital voting representation in the national legislature?
To my knowledge, Congresswoman, no countries deny their national capitals votes in the national legislature.
That's right, Mr. Henderson, and I appreciate that. None. That's the answer. This represents an extraordinary violation of democratic principle America claims to represent, right? Our country claims to represent the importance of representation. So now let's look at taxation. In fiscal year 2019, we continue to hear that D.C. paid $27.5 billion in federal taxes. That's more than 22 other states and territories. In fact, D.C. paid more taxes than Montana, Alaska, Wyoming, Vermont, all the U.S. territories, and all the U.S. foreign deployed service members combined. Put simply, if you oppose D.C. statehood, you support taxation without representation. You hear me? If you oppose D.C. statehood, then you support taxation without representation. And let's not forget that people of D.C. have always answered the call to serve whenever their country needs them, right?
Well, Republicans pretend to be so concerned about the taxpayer. Seems like they're less concerned when the majority of the population, I believe, in D.C. is African-American. And D.C. has a larger population than Vermont and Wyoming, two states that have two senators. D.C. has zero. I mean, they have, I think, you know, ornamental senators, but no real representation.
They don't have two votes in the
two
Senate.
Two votes, exactly.
And it is, I mean, there's just simply no rational argument that Republicans can make about this. There have been calls for local control in just about everything except for those things that they don't want there to be local control about. And so it's completely inconsistent. But there is something you're not thinking about, Emma.
You're right. I forgot that there were some compelling arguments on the right.
There are some very compelling arguments on the right as to why D.C. should not get statehood. Here is Zach Smith. He is from the Heritage Foundation, where all of the high-level right-wing Republican ideas come from. And here is one thing that I guess many people have not thought about, and that is the notion of undue influence that Washington, D.C. would have if it was a state.
Framers also wanted to avoid one state having undue influence over the federal government. There's no question that D.C. residents already impact the national debate. For the members here today, how many of you saw D.C. statehood yard signs or bumper stickers or banners on your way to this hearing today? I certainly did. Where else in the nation could such simple actions reach so many members of Congress?
Where else in the nation are there political signs?
Well, but that's like number five on the list of things that are absolutely insane about that. Because A, it is, I mean, the guys arguing that this influences people who do not get their votes from this. So just the idea that you would see the concept of D.C. statehood represented on print would have undue influence on you, as if like polls even have undue influence on. The whole point is there's no relationship between these lawmakers and the signs that they're seeing. They might as well be just reading about what's happening in a different country, because they don't represent these people. They feel no obligation. There's no way for these people to hold them to account. Even if signs were a method of influencing people, there's no way to hold these lawmakers accountable, because for the very reason that they don't live there and they're not elected by these people. It is, can you imagine coming from a think tank and just bouncing it around, looking around the think tank and saying, like, what about this? Well, you guys notice there's a lot of signs around here. Isn't that undue influence?
And you say think tank, which is important, because you know what might have a little more influence over members of Congress and senators are political donations. I mean, they're already pretty heavily compromised in their interests, and it has nothing to do with the fact that when they drive past the limo in a limo on their way to Congress that they see some yard signs. And just because they reside in D.C. and they may see some political activism, they also ostensibly reside in the state that they represent, and that should influence them as well. I just don't even understand. Well, I'm not supposed to.
Well, and the other part that is interesting is that if you really want to make an argument about what undue influence is, I mean, presumably undue influence would be that a smaller number of people have a greater influence than maybe people with more numbers.
Yes.
And that is a very good argument as to why one should probably abolish the Senate in the first place, because we have both on a macro scale, 40 more million people voted for the Democrats in the Senate than the Republicans, yet it's 50-50. And if you look at a state like Montana or Wyoming or the Dakotas, the number of people who control the same amount of votes as the number of people compared to the number of people in, say, like New York or California, they have... definitionally, that is undue influence. So yeah.
The Dakotas were made into two states so you could dilute Democrat power in the South. The Republicans did that for a specific reason.
And it also overrepresents white people. I mean, there is an overrepresentation of specific interests in those states. And the reason that D.C. statehood is seen as so terrifying to Republicans is, one, because it would actually more fairly disperse the Senate's power, because then there would be a more even balance. But two, because it does at least tangentially threaten white supremacy. And that's part of what these Senate norms uphold.
The fascinating thing to me still is just that, like, this guy does this as a profession, that he bounced this off of somebody at work, or probably should have, and nobody said, like, hey, dude, don't say that. That's embarrassing. Or it could be one of those situations where maybe he doesn't have many friends at the Heritage Foundation.
He looks like a libertarian.
He doesn't have many friends at the Heritage Foundation, yeah. And they basically said, oh, yeah, no, this is a good idea.
I know.
It's good enough. I feel like there's a lot of good enough. Like, we're just creating a veneer here. Like, you think it's good enough for Ron Johnson? It's definitely good enough for Ron Johnson.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. When we do, we're going to talk to... two different folks on the situation in Haiti. First up, it's going to be Jemima Pierre. She is a associate professor of African American Studies at UCLA. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report on the Zoom. Like to welcome Jemima Pierre. She's an associate professor of African American Studies at UCLA. Jemima, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's Jemima. Thanks for having me. No worries.
Jemima, let's just start. I mean, you've written a piece about the sort of ongoing narrative of black despots and white rulers in Haiti. Back up a little bit for us and give us a little bit of history. You also discussed the idea of a second coup, I guess, or era. Just give us a little bit of basic history on Haiti's attempts at self-government over the past, well, I mean, I guess we could go 200 years. We can touch on that, and then we'll get into the sort of more modern era.
Right. Well, part of it is, Haiti is the first black free republic in the world, the first successful slave revolt that resulted in the formation of the Haitian Republic in 1804. It's actually the second independent nation in the Western Hemisphere after the U.S., and so people don't realize that. And after that, what you have is this long history of U.S. not recognizing Haiti, and France, of course, charging Haiti an indemnity for its loss of land and enslaved Africans, right? So Haiti had to pay this. And I'm sure you all have heard this. Haiti had to pay this up until the 1980s, where it was paying France back for this revolution that it won against enslavement. So there's that. And then there's a long history.
You should say that was, we're talking 1801 was the end of that.
1804, yes. 1804. Yes. And so you have this long history of this black government, which became independent when slavery was still legal, right? The U.S., this is 1804, and then slavery did not end in the U.S. from 1865. In places like South America, like Brazil, slavery did not end until 1888. So you have this long history of this black nation that's been at the heels, I guess, of white supremacy for a very long time. And so it was punished for that. And some people say it's being punished for that. And so you fast forward so Haiti has always been, it was surrounded by the US, by the Europeans for a long time, naval blockades. No one wanted to trade with the nation when it first became independent. And then later on in 1915, that was the first occupation when the US military came in and occupied Haiti on the pretext of, protecting its interests. And, emptied its coffers, the gold was transferred to New York, and so you have all of this stuff happening. And then this was a 19-year occupation from 1915 to 19, to right before the war, right? So you have that. And during that occupation, insurgents, and people who were protesting were really put down, thousands were killed. And a lot of the soldiers were from the South. So there's a lot of really racist policing happening in Haiti during the occupation. So you fast forward again, you have the support of this major dictatorship, the 30-year dictatorship by Duvalier, Baby Doc and Papa Doc Duvalier. And Papa Doc was supported by the U.S. because he was anti-communist, right? So so you had that, and you had him develop this dictatorship that really lasted and terrorized the population for a very long time. And he was deposed in 1987, once France and the U.S., I guess, decided that they no longer needed him. And so 1987 is really the year where we really think about the beginnings, of recreating Haitian sovereignty, getting rid of this Duvalier dictatorship. And then, of course, you have, the first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, which was overwhelmingly supported by the poor people. Haiti, they say the poorest, the stereotype Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, which is not true. It's poor because it's completely exploited. It has all the gold, the minerals and oil and so on, right? So there's that. But with Aristide, then you had two coups d'etats supported by the CIA, one in 1991, right at 9 months after he came into power, and then one again in 2004 when the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Central Africa. So, and after that, then you have than, you know, what I call the second occupation. And ever since then is what you have, you know, so the UN, which really allowed this to happen. And you have, I've written a longer piece, you know, an academic piece. I'm an anthropologist, so I write in anthropology journals. And so I've written more about this occupation in the sense that once this coup d'etat happened, it was sanctioned by the UN Security Council, which is run, of course, you know, by the US and France, you know, and then they decided to deploy a peacekeeping mission because there was so much protest against the coup d'etat. And this peacekeeping mission has been there for a long time. And this is the same peacekeeping mission that brought cholera to Haiti that killed 30,000, you know, and that's, you know, behind a lot of violence and so on and so forth. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to talk about, you know, it's like 200 years of history, but it is my point with this article was really to talk about just the nonstop imperial meddling in Haiti when it comes to, you know, people trying to assert their sovereignty. And we always wonder why it is that Haiti, you know, requires so much interference and imposition, regardless of what it's trying to do, especially when it's trying to advocate for itself and for the masses of its people.
Well, that is, I mean, I think, you know, the question I think that is just sort of like, you know, begged to be asked is why? I mean, like, why? And maybe it's in part that it's about resources. I mean, it's stunning the natural resources that exist there, that are, of which the wealth, the value of that does not seem to reach the people ever. But what is it? I mean, is it obviously there's a huge part of white supremacy involved in this, but what is it that continually allows for the United States to be meddling in this way? And other countries.
And other countries. Well, I mean, we do think white supremacy is part of that, definitely. But I do think Haiti has this, you know, has been strategically possible. So I was reading, if you read like this, I forgot who it's by, but the Monroe Doctrine, who this U.S. Military official talking about how significant that area, that location is for U.S. Policy. So if you think about, and there's this an island called Mole St. Nicholas where the U.S. government has been trying to get from Haiti for a long time because they want to stage a military. And if you think about, you know, the pivot to Asia, the idea that this area provides a way for Southcom, you know, Southern Command, to actually have access to these supposed scary governments in Latin America, Venezuela, and so on and so forth, then you see the need for Haiti. The other thing is there's Guantanamo, which is about to be given back to Cuba. And so, you know, you need a replacement for the Guantanamo base as, you know, the pivot to Asia gets established. And so then you think about through Haiti, the Panama Canal, then you're in Asia, right? And so you have to think about all of that, the strategic geopolitical processes. And one of the things that actually kept this dictator in the making, that's what I call him, in power, was the fact that he, for the first time, went against Venezuela with the U.S. with Trump. You know, so he recognized Juan Guaido, which was something Haiti would have never done, considering Venezuela's close relationship with Haiti historically.
And yet, have they called for his resignation? No, the United States, I thought they've kind of supported new elections. But to my knowledge, despite these pro-democracy protests, the United States has not gone as far as to call for the resignation of Moyes.
Oh, no, of course not. Well, part of it is there's no way Moyes would be as bold and still be in power without the consent of the so-called international community. And that is the U.S., that is the UN, that is especially the OAS. In fact, the OAS has gone out of its way to affirm Moyes needs to stay in power, right? And if they get tired of him, if the violence gets too much, and that's what we're assuming, in a few months it might be too much for them, they might want to replace him. They're probably looking for a replacement, but there's no way that Moyes is in power without the consent of the US, because part of the other thing being under occupation is that There are three groups that control U.S. politics. So there's no sovereignty. So there's the core group. And I don't know if you've heard of the core group, which is a group of nations, you know, United States, France, Canada, the U.S., OAS, the EU, you know, Germany, Spain, and Brazil get together all the time and make decisions on Haiti, right? That, the OAS. So they all get together and they decide. And so if they affirm, you know, so they were the ones responsible for Moise getting elected to begin with, because Moise was deeply popular from the very beginning. So was his predecessor. So the predecessor, Michel Martelly, who started the party that he's in, is, you know, known for corruption and so on and so forth. But he was actually forced in, right, by the Obama administration against the wishes of the people. The election results were from the first round to the second round were changed by the OAS to actually put him into second place. So you have to know that the last set of elections, Moise was handpicked by this guy who was actually forced on the people. So people have been protesting this for the longest time. There have been nonstop protests since 2011, since these elections, and no one pays attention, because until the OAS and the UN and the US say something, nothing will happen. And so to me, that is not sovereignty.
Jamima, can you speak to the G9, as it's called, and their relationship, what impact they have on the population and their relationship to Moise?
Oh, you're talking about the gang, the G9 gang, right? Yes. So the thing is, it's very difficult to, the situation in Haiti is so volatile. Things change, alliances change all the time. It actually reminds me of, like, you know, the Haitian Revolution, where alliances change and, you know, the craziness happened and all of a sudden, you know, there's freedom, right? So I'm hoping something like that. But the G9 is seen as this gang that's aligned, you know, led by this guy named Barbecue, that they say is you know, is a gang that's supported by Moise and that's wreaking havoc against protesters and so on throughout the city. And I have to say, you know, for the longest time, this has been happening for a long time. Like, so gang, you know, the arming of young, poor, unemployed young men by the elite, you know, and the elite of Haiti is a bunch of, they're non-Black elite, right? They're from, you know, Syrians, Italians, French. There are like 8 or 9 families who actually run all the businesses in Haiti. They've always armed local gangs to go after each other, to, you know, to get their political points across. But the gang thing population has gotten, the gang situation has gotten really bad, because there's all these arms and you wonder where all these arms are coming from. They're everywhere, right? In addition to US providing the local police arms and ammunition. And so this G9, and, you know, I don't claim to know much more except for what is, you know, he's the big boogeyman right now. But I have to say the G9 was actually sanctioned by the UN in the fall, where they're saying that he's a peacekeeper. So we have to think about what that means for the G9. But there's a lot of violence. A lot of it is state controlled. A lot of the military equipment that these gangs have come from the government. And a lot of people are saying it's coming straight from the top. But the government is funded and supplied by outsiders, right? Because if Haitians are so poor, they don't build their own arms. They don't have their own tanks, you know, and so on.
I know you're not necessarily an expert on this, but that dynamic is like, how do we characterize that? Because it feels like those it is a different that relationship with the gangs. I mean, even call, you know, is sort of a different dynamic than we've seen in other countries in this area. Like, it's part sort of, I mean, death squad on some level that is deployed to tamp down any type of dissent or protest, but it's also part drug cartel on some level, or at least cartel. I mean, how do you characterize those things? Is there anything that is like sort of, is there an analogy?
Right. There's no analogy, but you have to also think about what's going on in Somalia or places like that, where you do have different forces that are being supported and armed for proxy wars. Right. And I do think what's going on in Haiti, what we don't remember is when the CIA and the U.S. deposed Aristide in 2004, Aristide had destroyed the army, that disbanded the military. But if you look at the WikiLeaks papers, it shows that the U.S. government officials actually reintegrated these rogue military people into the Haitian National Police. So a lot of these so-called gangs are actually former police members who are from a time before, who were always already part of the army and the military that we reintegrated. So now there's a major split actually within the police in Haiti. You have the people who feel like you know, and this is when we start seeing the beginnings of dictatorship, where the president himself has his own personal 4,000 member, all he calls them the all black group within the police that he has separated out and then putting them against the regular police. And so I have to, you know, part of that is to also say that there's, I want to refrain from saying this is like endemic to Haiti, because I do think it's a manufactured crisis. And it's clearly manufactured when you see who's funding what and how it is that certain groups get sanctioned and certain groups don't. But we have to take this gang and this, you know, the violence that's developing and this fracturing of the Haitian police back to the fact that the dissolved Haitian police was then armed and trained in the DR, brought back to help take down Aristide, and then reintegrated into the Haitian police to make scene more palatable. And these are the same forces now that are coming back to terrorize the population.
You mentioned those WikiLeaks cables, which discussed that. They're one of the other big revelations during the Obama administration from WikiLeaks cables was the Obama administration's, at the very least, I mean, and maybe you have a better sense of how much they were involved in this, but their issue that they had with the raising of
the minimum wage. Yes.
Yeah. Will you just explain that? Just so that folks get a sense of both A, how much we as in America, United States, have micromanaged things in Haiti, but also, it's to prevent people from getting a minimum wage when we're talking about like literally cents. I mean, it's just sort of shocking.
It was like a 30. I have to remember. It was like a 37. It was a 37 cent up, you know, wage hike, right? So it was like the wage was 24 cents an hour, right? So the U.S. and then they wanted to bring it up to 37 cents, and the Obama administration fought tooth and nail against that. And I have to say, the Obama administration has been, people don't know this, has been, the WikiLeaks papers will show you, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Obama have been horrible to Haiti. And the fact, even like for the coup d'etat, you know, with the replacement of the government, where Hillary left, this was during the Arab Spring, she flew from the Middle East, went straight to Haiti and threatened to put the sitting president on a plane out to exile if he didn't agree with the OAS votes, right? So we have to know about how it is that, you know, they wanted the bump, the 37 cents bump for Haiti. And this is what the old president always said, that, you know, we want to be people who live with dignity. People want to work. But the fact that you want to squeeze this group of people, the suffering, for this amount of money tells you how just horrible U.S. policies are and how little regard they have for human beings outside of the U.S. And inside, too, right, if you think about working peoples.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, Jemima, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We're going to put links to the pieces that you've written, and folks can get a better sense of what that history has been and what's ongoing. And we're going to take a break and to look forward to what the Biden administration policy has been in these short few weeks. We're going to be talking to Brian Concannon from
IJDH. Right.
Exactly. Jemima, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Right, take care.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be talking to Brian Concannon. He is the executive director of Project Blueprint and advisor to the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We'll be right back in just a moment. We'll be right back. We are back on the Zoom. I'd like to welcome to the program Brian Concannon, Executive Director of Project Blueprint, Advisor to Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Brian, thank you for joining Emma and I. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you.
So we were just talking to Jemima Pierre, who is gave us a little bit of a background on the history of Haiti and the U.S. and also obviously France and whatnot. I want to talk about let's just start with how Haiti fits in with the Biden foreign policy, and particularly, like, if we have a sense of, based upon what we've heard about the relationship between really the last four or five successive administrations and Haiti, if we're going to see any type of change with the Biden administration, at least from what we can tell 60 days in.
Sure. Well, first, anytime you're ever talking about U.S. policy in Haiti, you can never lose sight of the historical context that Professor Pierre just related. We like to think the past is past, but it is present. It informs, and especially the white supremacy aspects, informs U.S. policy to Haiti today and Haitians' reactions to it. I think there's kind of three things going on with the current U.S. policy to Haiti. One is that we're still in our own democratic transition. We have a confirmed Secretary of State, a confirmed UN ambassador. The third State Department official confirmed was just confirmed yesterday. So you don't have Biden's full team in place, and we're some extent on Obama running on Trump legacy people. The second thing, I think, to the extent that the administration is paying attention to Haiti, they're mostly hoping that Haiti stays calm or stays low on the radar screen so they can get to other things. Haiti's not its top priority. But I think the third thing is that it is clear so far from what we know about Biden administration foreign policy, that its policy is much less progressive than its domestic policy is going to be, and will be to a decent extent a continuation of the policies of the Obama administration.
Well, I mean, I characterize that. I mean, is it basically we're going to try and control who essentially runs Haiti? I mean, is that essentially what for lack of any nuance, is that essentially what the Obama administration and I guess ultimately the Trump administration policy was, that we're not terribly interested in democracy in Haiti because we want the ability to control who's going to be running that country?
You asked a great question with Professor Pierre about why the U.S. is doing it. And I think all of those things are true that you discussed earlier. And I would add that there is deep concern with Black people getting to vote who they want to vote for. To understand why that's problematic with respect to Haiti, we can look at Georgia. I mean, what happened when African-Americans in Georgia voted in a decisive way? We have a huge response, which is trying to repress their votes as much as possible. Same thing happened in Milwaukee for the primaries. And I think that there really is a concern of allowing free democracy in Haiti because there will be a challenge to much of the world's social order that keeps countries like Haiti poor and countries like the United States relatively wealthy. And the United States just did not want that kind of a challenge in 1804 when the world was run by slaveocracies, and does not want that kind of a challenge in 2021 when the world is run by large corporations.
Tony Blinken spoke out early in Biden in Biden's term, really, even earlier than where we're at right now, and basically said that we are recognizing Guaido as the true leader of Venezuela, even though Guaido himself isn't necessarily seeking that in the same way he had been before. It's just bizarre to onlookers. But how does that portend for policy in Haiti then? Because you indicated it won't be as progressive as the domestic agenda. It seems to me that it's going to be fairly right wing based on those early indicators.
Secretary Blinken gave a really interesting speech in late February to the UN Human Rights Council, and he said two really good things. First, he said, look, the U.S. is back. We're engaging with international diplomacy, which was good. Second, he conceded that the U.S. has a lot to do to keep its own human rights in order, especially with respect to economic injustice and racial discrimination. But then the third thing, when he started listing the problem countries in the world, he listed Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua as the first three places. And this was really going back. It was a flashback for me to college. It was the Reagan administration, and we're all of a sudden worrying about the Sandinistas being a 2 days drive away from Arlington, Texas. It really is kind of a neo-Cold War mentality, not adapted to the reality on the ground in Haiti or anywhere else.
Well, I mean, that's what I was going to bring up. It's not just not adapted to the reality in these countries. It's also not adapted to the reality anywhere else. Ostensibly, right? I mean, because, what is it? I mean, you said like there's a concern about what would happen if, people in Haiti had the opportunity to vote in. Like, what does that concern look like? I mean, is it because we don't have the sort of, the excuse of, well, there's a domino effect, and if communism takes hold and we don't put a check on it in Cuba, it's going to spread to Central America. Well, I mean, there is no big sort of like funding mechanism coming from the Soviet Union anymore to fund communist expansion. What we're afraid of now, those dominoes, what is it like? Give me a sense of what it is that fear that we're afraid of is going to be the dominoes, because it's obviously not going to be communism that is exported from the Soviet Union. What is that fear? It's just going to be just the idea of maybe egalitarianism or what?
It's actually there. It is still the domino concern, but the concern never was with communism. The concern always was with popular democracy breaking out. I had a conversation back in the 90s when I asked a special forces guy who had been in the special forces in Haiti. He was an American military intelligence officer, I asked him kind of the same question you did. Why is the U.S. investing so much in undermining democracy in Haiti? And he said, look, I was involved in the 80s in Central America and doing military intelligence. And when we were getting briefed as to what the biggest threat to U.S. interests were, we were told it was liberation theology. It wasn't Marxism. It was priests going around saying that the rich should share with the poor. And I think that is still the concern. I mean, we live in a deeply unequal society, in a deeply unequal world, and there's that is inherently unstable. And the U.S. is not able to accept any kind of the ruling classes of the United States are not willing to accept any challenge because they're afraid of that instability.
Jamima Pierre brought up the AOS, the OAS, the Organization of American States, and the core group, which is it characterized the core group for us, but also discuss the roles that both those organizations are playing, because ostensibly, I mean, it feels like it's just a way to make it look like the United States is not being unilateral. And in fact, I mean, could you just characterize the role they play, I guess?
That's exactly it. The reason why the OAS, the OAS is run by a man named Secretary General Insulza. He was going to lose his reelection battle, but the Trump administration intervened to get him elected as the head because he's a hardliner against Venezuela. And one of the reasons why we're so supportive of Haiti was because Haiti provided a critical vote in the OAS against Venezuela. And this is really back, I mean, it's going back to the 80s where we supported Jean-Claude Duvalier because he was a vote in the OAS against Cuba. And we're still using these regional institutions. And, I agree, you're right, that it is giving the appearance of of multilateralism, but it really is the U.S., although also you do have France and Canada who have very identical interests who are also joining in.
Well, I mean, expand just a little bit on French and Canadian interests. Are those simply those interests that they have corporate entities that are doing a lot of business there and they want to protect those interests and are afraid of like some type of movement to nationalize the resources or these corporations? Is that essentially it?
It's not nationalizing. That's no longer the fear. The fear is that a government might demand a fair return on the extraction of those resources. So Canada specifically is very heavily invested in mining in Haiti. In France, it's less resources. It's more the restitution debt. Professor Pierre talked about that Haiti had to pay a restitution debt to France. In 2003, the Haitian government demanded that back. And I worked on the legal case a little bit. And it's actually a fairly strong legal case. The French response when Haiti threatened to take it to the International Court of Justice was to join the U.S. and remove Haiti's president. That's how seriously they took it.
Can you, I mean, just the just to be clear, I mean, just reiterate, because that restitution, I was not aware of that. And it just seems nuts to me. But what that restitution that Haiti was paying France was ostensibly for what?
It was for the lost, the quote, property that the French slave owners lost when Haiti became independent. And that includes their land and their farm equipment. It also includes the slaves that they lost when Haiti emancipated the slaves. So as Professor Pierre mentioned, I mean, Haiti won the old-fashioned way. They beat Napoleon. But then the French said, well, we're going to keep putting warships off the shores and we're going to reinvade and reinstitute slavery unless you pay us this huge sum. And they were able to get away with it because nobody else would help Haiti. The U.S., Britain, all of the other leading countries, which were slave-owning countries, they were not willing to support Haiti against France.
I mean, it's not hard to imagine that. I mean, if you had that 100, 200 years worth of payment was actually put back into the infrastructure of Haiti in some fashion, what the country would look like today.
And it was that was part of it. It wasn't just extracting money. The whole purpose of the debt was to keep Haiti from being successful so that nobody could point to a successful country run by freed slaves. And it made Haiti miss out on the whole 19th century industrial revolution. It prevented Haiti from investing in education, social services, basic governance, and kept it weak and exploitable up through now.
Can you expand on the United Nations role in upholding the I guess hegemony of the United States, France, Canada, etc., when it comes to Haiti? Because I feel like a lot of people still see the United Nations as, I guess, more divorced from Western or U.S. influence, I should say, than it actually is.
Great question. I actually got to Haiti in 1995 as a volunteer, a UN volunteer for a human rights mission. And, at the time, there were accusations that we were a tool of the U.S. And I think that was partially right, but only partially right. That changed in 2004 when President Aristide was literally kidnapped on a U.S. plane and sent to the Central African Republic. And the U.S. troops entered the country and kind of maintained order, prevented democracy from breaking out. But in 2004, we needed our soldiers because we were losing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so the U.S. got the U.N. to bring peacekeepers in basically to free up U.S. soldiers. And even they did it under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which allows for peacekeeping missions if there's a grave threat to international peace. There's no grave threat to international peace. And Brazil, which led the mission, originally said there is no justification under Chapter 7. But the U.S. said, well, look, we'll let you lead this mission if you take it. And, if you drop those objections. And so everybody let the objections drop. You had a peacekeeping mission that was there for decades. It brought cholera that you know, that killed over 10,000 people. It spent I think it was close to $9 million. I'm sorry, $900 million. $7 billion. And it really helped create the conditions now where you have this succession of right-wing parties running basically a left-wing country.
Is that the core group? I mean, was that essentially the core group that came in and made up of that so-called peacekeeping mission?
It was the United States under President Bush. They really led it, and the Security Council authorized. And there's a lot of overlap between the core group and the Security Council. And they authorized. I mean, yeah, Brazil was brought in because it was brought in to lead the peacekeeping mission because they wanted the coverage they got from having a South American country rather than a European or U.S. country.
Well, characterize the core group for us, and also expand on like what interests is in Brazil. What is the interest for Brazil? I mean, I understand like, okay, well, if we get to lead the mission, like what does that do for Brazil in that instance?
Yeah, it was, I mean, this was President Bush had a very clever play with Brazil. Back at that time, there were talks of expanding the Security Council, the UN, to include more permanent members. And there's a lot of talk that it was that Brazil and India were two of the front runners. And Brazil was given to believe that if it could prove its worthiness, which meant leading a peacekeeping mission in a black country and doing what it was told to do, that would increase its chances of getting one of these one of the permanent seats at the UN Security Council. All that talk has since died down. But I think it was something that the Brazilian military liked. It was prestigious for them. But certainly within Brazil, when you talk to Brazilians, they were appalled that their country was involved in this kind of activity.
All right. So lastly, expand on that core group for us so that we get a sense of what their role is and what their function is.
Yeah. It's basically, and there's been a whole, there were the Friends of Haiti. There's a whole series of these things, and it's all the same thing. It's all a coalition led by the United States with at least France and Canada involved and any other less white countries they can bring in to give it some credibility. But those countries never have any real meaningful decision-making power. And it's basically the U.S. and secondary Canada and France calling the shots.
So if we wanted to, looking forward, are there any type of sort of milestones or markers that would give us a sense, you know, we're early in the Biden administration, but is there any type of like moves that we could, I'm reading in the paper 2 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, that gives me an indication of, okay, this is the path that clearly the Biden administration is headed on. What would they be? What would those markers be that we should look for?
Well, one thing to look for is what's happening in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which has been really interesting. Even before the Biden administration said that they felt Moise had another year in his term, the leaders of the Foreign Affairs Committee said, no, Moise's term ends on February 7th. They've pushed back since then several times. A week and a half ago, they had a hearing bringing up some Haitian experts, and both the Haitian experts and almost every Democrat on the committee talked about how the U.S. was really supporting the wrong side in Haiti. So what I'm most hopeful about is that we are having leadership in the House Foreign Affairs Committee and other people that aren't on the committee, like Maxine Waters has always been great on Haiti, and that those people are going to force a better change of policy. And if a better policy will be, first of all, there's a referendum that the president is trying to organize in June that will be a huge unconstitutional power grab. The U.S. needs to stop that. Second, it needs to support, at least acknowledge Haitian civil society's consensus that the president's term has ended, and it needs to stop propping him up. Most Haitians will tell you if the U.S. stops propping Moise up, he's going to be forced to either resign or negotiate significant democratic concessions. So that's really the big thing is stopping propping Moise up. not supporting the referendum power grab. They also can do other things. There's Magnitsky Act sanctions that they can apply to government officials that are involved in corruption and brutality. They can try to, you know, allow a better process happening through the OAS and other regional institutions.
So this is going to be a story about Democrats in the House, maybe some in the Senate, pressuring the Biden administration, and the Biden administration may be getting pressured. Where are the Republicans in all this? And we just have about, I don't know, about 45 seconds.
So far, the Republicans, I think, are more in the shadows. I think one of the things that Democrats always worry about is that Republicans are going to hammer them on Haiti. Whenever there's a left-wing government in Haiti, the Republicans hammer. Whenever there's a right-wing government in Haiti, the Republicans don't say anything. But the Democrats are worried that if you have a democratic transition in Haiti and you get the kind of people that the Haitians would elect, then the Republicans will start criticizing Haiti.
Ryan Kincannon, Executive Director of Project Blueprint, Advisor to the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for covering Haiti.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to finish things up. Well, it's another one of those situations, Emma, where we as a country basically go in and take what we want because we can.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I find some of the insights there just so horrifying. The fact that basically Haiti is under financial penalty for being enslaved, like continued.
Well, no, for being not enslaved.
I'm not enslaved, or sorry, for resisting slavery, basically.
Yes.
Which is an unbelievable, not unbelievable, but an obviously disturbing
dynamic.
More NGOs than any other country, so.
More NGOs down there.
Harder NGOs.
Exactly. All right, well, that's it for us today. We will see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we will see you now. Nomi is going to join us. She's going to join us a little bit late. I just got a text from her. But Nomi will be joining us. You can check out Nomi's show today at 3 p.m. Matthew Lawson, author of Planet on Fire, will be joining Nomi. That, of course, is youtube.com/ The Nomi Key Show, and twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. So check that out. And a reminder, this program relies on your support. It is only because of our members that we're able to do this day in, day out. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show. Free of ads. We didn't have any ads. We don't have ads every day. We try, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But you can get the show free of ads, the free show, and then you get the fun half. And then we're also, you know, we've got all sorts of things in the hopper.
Like the stream.
Hopper. Oh, yeah. Like the stream. The hopper.
The hopper.
And it
sounds like it's like indistinguishable from harbor.
Hoppa. Sometimes the hoppa dumps things into the hoppa. So like the stream, subscribe to the channel if you haven't already through the various mechanisms in which you watch this show. Also, Matt. Oh, I should also say justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority to get 10% off. And people didn't know that I voice half the time the AM Quickie. Someone on YouTube
thought that was pretty clear.
Yeah, I thought so too. But somebody on Twitter, rather, was complaining about my, you know, way of speaking, and which which I have to say, I think is perfectly legitimate. I mean, the idea that I've been able to do this for 15 years with the diction I have and the I'm not terribly trained in this, you know, I came from the acting comedy world more, but certainly I understand, perfectly legitimate, but I'm old. It's not going to change probably, I would have to say. But in the course of that, they say like, oh, and I can't listen to the AM quickie because that voice. And I'm like, well, that's me without all of those problems because I read that.
Mm-hmm.
And I still didn't do it.
So some people do like the slower cadence?
Yeah, some people do. I don't know. Some people don't like the slower cadence or the faster cadence. And in that case...
Sounds like you just shouldn't watch the show.
I was going to say, like, there's only so much I can do. I can only either go slower or faster. Anyways, amquickie.com. 7 minutes of headline news from a left perspective. And news, actually, that you won't hear... We don't even cover some of those stories on this show because we just run out of time. But our writers for AM Quickie, they find a bunch of stories that you're going to want to know about. And and it gives you an opportunity. Maybe I'll pursue more of this, or I just like this is something I should know in the background. I mean, I think people really enjoy it. So amquickie.com. Like I said, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian? I guess what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Sorry.
Yeah, Thursday night, Shyamalan, the social member of the CSO Council, will also.
You should listen back to this.
Inexplicable, yeah.
Completely.
Really? That's something else on my internet, I feel like. It's still bad.
Every time you talk, you turn into a robot.
Remember that happened with my audio earlier? Maybe you need to just do what I did and restart the computer.
How about now? I restarted it. Is that in there?
No.
No. Sawat and Wasombre on Left Reckoning Thursday.
It sounded like you said Shama.
Someone Bray on
Shama Sawant from
Wasombre.
And Was. Okay. Oh. All right. Great. So there it is on Left Reckoning.
I speak Lek now.
It's weird. You sound great. You're like millions of miles away. So
I'm sorry if I keep cracking my neck. I just like there is something right here, right in the back.
Wow, there's like, a lot of. We're all falling apart, folks.
I don't
know. It's if it's not the internet, it's one other thing. All right. See you 646-257-3920 in the fun half.
I thought we were.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some libertarians out there. take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.